The Affairs Committee will come to order. It's 10 minutes after 8, and if I'm not mistaken, this is the 29th of March 2007. With us today, on my left, is Representative Dahl, Representative Coghill, Representative Grunberg, on my right, Representative Johnson, and Vice Chair Bob Roses. And today, we have on our agenda HB 171, which is to accommodate the 90-day session, trying to put the apples back in the apple cart. And HB 179, which refers to PERS and TERS. And it's very interesting, on the House floor the other day, I made an announcement on this. I said for PERS and STERS. Well, the reason why I said that is I'm actually a retired teacher from California, among other adventures. And in California, it's a state teacher's retirement system. And so I'm thinking STERS, and it's TERS here. So whatever it is, I do get that check, and I hereby disclose that. But it's not from Alaska, so I think we're okay. So with that, I'm going to bring up CS for House Bill number 171, and it looks like we need to adopt the version. Does somebody make a motion, please, to work with version M?
Mr.
Anybody?
Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move and ask unanimous consent that the State Affairs Committee adopt the M version, which is labeled 25-LS0653/M Cook 32607.
Very fine. And without objection, we'll be working with version M. And with that, I would invite Representative Coghill to bring us up to date on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this bill, the reason we have the CS is because of the amendment that Representative Johnson put in on moving the legislature in the first year of its legislature up to the January time that we normally start at now, and then the second year starting in February. Beyond that, I don't know that we really need to go through the bill. We get some amendments, and Mr. Chairman, if it's okay with you, I'd like to go ahead and just move the first amendment and explain why.
I think I'd be, but before, so next January, when we come back to this place of adventure, we begin when this in 08, we come in January or February, if this
January.
We come back in January.
Oh, no,
February.
I'm sorry.
February.
The first session would be January. The second session would be February.
Good. Come back. Then on the gubernatorial election, we come back on 8.
We come back like we do now. We come back the late, 3 weeks in January.
I just want to explain
second
that.
Monday.
Second Monday.
We're listening audience. So it's basically every other year.
So that would mean then that next year we would come back in February.
That's what I understand.
Right.
If we get the effective dates.
Yeah, and this gives us this goes with the initiative that people in the wisdom did vote for. And did you have an amendment to Representative Coghill?
Because of the many changes, first of all, I'd like to move conceptual amendment number 1, which is the M.1.
Okay. I'll object for discussion.
Fine, thank you. Objection for discussion by Representative Johnson, Representative Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, what this does is it puts a sunset date on it. It gives us 3 years to work the system under this law, and then we have to reevaluate and actually reinstate. And I think that's the wise thing to do, because I think we'll have at that time a working knowledge of how this works, and it may very well be that there might be some reevaluations on whether the 90-day is right or whether we got all of our modifications right. So that's why you have in section lines 6 through 10 all of the reinstatement of laws in unamended form. It just resets to where we're at today. There are the reason why it's conceptual amendment, I think that there's I'll defer to Representative Grunberg, because him and I agreed to do this together, and he helped draft this. But I think the reason it's conceptual is that the drafting manual has to make insert it wherever it fits best.
Okay. So before we go to discussion, I'll ask Reverend Grunberg to build on that if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. By the way, we have Tam Cook available to answer her questions, your questions on any of this. And what we're doing here...
Excuse me.
Sure.
Yes. Oh, she is, Tim is online, thank you. Excuse me, go ahead, please.
Oh, she's on the line.
Well, she's available for questions if we need it.
Okay, okay. The, what this bill basically does is it would sunset the new law on June the 1st, 2009, which would give the legislature a chance to evaluate at that time, extend it if we wished, or amend it, or whatever we wanted to do in the public's best interest. And that's it in 25 words or less. And Pam can, if she had written this whole thing out, then it would have taken pages and pages, and it would have been very complicated to look at. So that's, it's the effective dates that that really are what she has done. And she has repealed one thing in here, so that's something technical, I believe, and I'm going to pull that up so you can see what it is, 2405-150B.
It's almost 25 words or less, but...
It really is. Mr. Chair, I'd like to get Tam on the line to describe one thing that she is doing.
Ms. Cook, are you online?
Mr. Chairman, I am, sir.
Yes. Can I ask a question?
Yes, yes. Reverend Gerber has a question for you.
Yes.
Ms. Cook, we're looking at the conceptual amendment with the sunset date.
Yes, sir.
Do you have that handy?
I do.
Okay, my question is on line 3. It repeals 2405-150B, and I don't see that either in the statutes or in the bill.
I'm sorry. That is the initiated language that creates the 90-day session, sir, and it actually does not appear in statute or even on the electronic database, alas, because the election was held so late and then the results certified so late that we were unable to get it printed in the statutes.
Oh,
but that is... 2405-150B is the initiated language that says the legislature shall meet for 90 consecutive days.
Thank you very much. Representative Cargo has another question. Representative Gruenberg.
We do look alike, Mr. Chair.
They do, and,
he's
so,
better
and,
looking
so,
than
and
me.
So do I.
Mr. Chair, the members should have in their packet a copy of the initiative. I know we have a big packet here, and if the members would flip through the many pages we have. It's a very, Tam, could you read us that language? It's one, oh, here it is. Okay, the language, Mr. Chair, if I may read that statute.
Please.
The initiative said, adds a new AS 2405-150B, quote, the legislature shall adjourn from a regular session within 90 consecutive days, including the day the legislature first convenes in that regular session, unquote. And just for the record, what we are doing here in this amendment would be constitutional, Ms. Cook? Through the chair.
Through the chair, yes, it would be. The Constitution allows the legislature to repeal an initiative within no sooner than 2 years after it becomes effective.
And for the record,
it
is not an outright repeal. It is a sunset, which will require the legislature to re-examine and see how this is working, and they have public hearings and public.
And that is correct, is it not, Ms. Cook?
Mr. Chairman, the way it is drafted, it is an outright repeal, but it is an outright repeal that does not take effect for 2.5 years. So the legislature, of course, could pass legislation to undo that which it has done before it takes effect.
So there's nothing whatsoever in this language that would go against the will of the people as expressed in the initiative. Is that correct?
I cannot say that, Mr. Chair. I don't know that it is the will of the people that the 90-day session be repealed in 2 years.
No, I did not mean that. I said there's nothing in this amendment that would go against the will of the people as expressed in the initiative, which established the 90-day session. Is that correct? I want to make that perfectly clear.
For the period of the 2 years within which the legislature is restricted from repealing an initiative.
Thank you. No other questions. Let's Let's discuss this amendment at this point, then we'll take action. Representative Dahl.
I did not find that in my packet.
The initiative language.
The what?
I said I did not find the initiative language.
Oh, okay, fine, thank you.
But this is it.
Okay. Any other questions on this amendment? If not, amendment's been moved. Somebody objected. Who objected?
I object.
Do you move the objection?
I will. Yes, sir. I will withdraw my objection.
Conceptual amendment number one has passed, and we'll go now to amendment number two. Do I have somebody move amendment number two, please?
Mr. Chairman, move amendment number two, which is M2 by written by Tam Cook.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, this one is brought to my attention by the administration, and what I did was I asked them, is there anything in the change that we made last time that moved the first session up to January and left the second session in February that made it difficult for the administration to respond to our timelines? And so we do have a member from the administration here, if you want to ask them to come up and help explain this. But what it did was it specified what would happen in the odd number of years and what would happen in the even number of years.
But is Mr. Boucher in the audience? Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I did not see the language of the amendment.
Please identify yourself for us.
John Boucher, Office of Management and Budget.
And Mr. Chairman, he gave me the suggestions. I had it drafted by Ledge Legal, and that's
yes.
I think he still knows what the content
yes.
is.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. If I could just draw your attention to the comments that we had in Section 12. Page 6, line 18, this speaks to when the governor's supplemental appropriations are introduced by. Our concern was in the odd-numbered years, or those years in which the session would start in January, that the timeline would simply be too tight to produce those amendments, would move them up, for instance, to as early as January 13th. And so we propose that in the odd-numbered years that it would be the 30th day. And a similar issue with page 7, line 20, page 6, line 21, the introduction of the supplemental budget. If we moved it to the 15th day in those odd-numbered years, you would be essentially receiving an amended budget about January 23, which would be a very, very crunch time frame for all of those involved, and it would ultimately result in many more amendments offered after that particular time. So we propose that in those odd numbered years, it would be the 30th day.
Okay.
And then related to the time frame in Section 16, the fifth day of the session following a gubernatorial election would be an awful tight time frame for the governor to have all of their appointments ready. So we proposed in an election year following, or the first session following an election year following a gubernatorial election, then that deadline would be moved to the 30th day.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Boucher? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, Mr. Boucher sent us a memo dated March, a letter to Representative Coghill, dated March 22, that I believe I quoted at our last meeting. Mr. Boucher, do you happen to have your letter handy?
No.
And that describes the reason for the amendment, does it not?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, and I'd just like that entered in the record.
Be on the record. Any other questions, Mr. Boucher? If not, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any further discussion on amendment number two?
I did have a quick question for Mr. Boucher. Did So your department then fully supports this amendment number two, including the line that cuts your salary in half? Sorry, sir. Just, it looked like you needed to wake up. I withdraw my objection.
That's the next amendment. It's coming down.
Sorry.
That's the next one here.
I withdraw my amendment.
All right. Thanks, sir.
Okay. So amendment number two has passed, and we now move on to amendment number three. Mr. Three comes after two. Would somebody move?
Yes, I
care to move amendment number three.
I will do that, Mr. Chair.
And that's by Representative Grunberg.
I'd ask Mr. Cohen. Did that the?
No, Mr. You want Mr. Cohen to come up here?
No, no, no. Do we have the new amendment number three?
Yes.
I'd ask this.
Yes.
This is new amendment number three.
I don't seem to have it.
It's the one written in blue ink. Replace the other one.
Oh, you were talking, so I wasn't able to switch it out.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Trying to pull a fast one, it didn't work.
Yeah. You want to cut his salary in half.
It's tough when you don't have your own amendment. Okay. Mr. Chair, this is a little different than the rest of the bill. What it will do is set forth a procedure by which the legislature can conduct its business during the interim telephonically, because we're going to have a longer interim. And this will allow, for example, this committee to meet, and one of the representatives who lives in Ketchikan could be there, one of the representatives who lives in North Pole could be there, and one lives here in Juneau and the rest of us in Anchorage. And it is a modern way that many committees do business in the business world, and will allow us actually to take the work of the legislature to the people. And I feel strongly that that we should conduct our business in the interim, and we should go out to the people, because regardless of the length of the session or where the legislature convenes, Alaska is such a big state that there's no way we can effectively cover it without doing something like this. And if I may go over what the amendment does, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Subsection C allows a chair of a standing or special committee to convene a committee during the interim. And I'm going to apologize. There is something wrong with this sentence. I talked to Representative Coghill about it and agreed to change it. This provision was taken from a bill that was introduced in the last legislature as Section 5 in House Bill 22. I copied it whole cloth, and there was something that neither one of us
would
liked.
Would you care to make an amendment to the amendment?
Could I, please?
Do we want to object to this amendment before we start doing this?
I thought you did.
Discussion?
I will object.
Not.
Oh, yeah. I object.
That was just Reverend an objectional Dahl, period.
Three objected by Representative Dahl.
Okay. Thank you.
I missed that. Thank you.
I would like to change 30 days notice to 14 days notice.
Okay. Any objection? Without objection, Amendment 1 to Amendment 3 has passed.
The reason I'm asking for that change is because 30 days is unnecessarily long, and the legislature committee should be able to conduct their business.
We've already approved the amendment to the amendment.
I just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you. So that's the first section in the bill, and the notice must include the subject and the number of the measure to be heard, and that's the normal practice now. Subsection D allows the members to attend the meeting by telephonically or teleconference, and to vote. The vote must be conducted on the record in a manner that the public and the committee members know the vote of the member who attends telephonically and by teleconference, and that's customarily done now. The secretary simply calls the roll, and each member present announces their position.
And that is done now with the LBNA or
no,
Legislative Council?
Every committee.
Well, I know that, but doing the interim.
Yes.
And so which committee has to meet to an end? That's Legislative Council?
Alleged Council.
And they can do that now?
Yes.
So this is simply extend that to the other committees of the legislature.
And LBNA does too, as I understand it.
Fine. So we're not really breaking new ground, other than extend to all the committees, not just the council and the LBNA?
With one exception. And by the way, for the record, LBNA is legislative budget and audit. The exception is the difference between standing and special committees on the one hand, and the other two committees, is the other two committees don't consider legislation. They consider housekeeping measures, and they act as committees, like they approve leases and settle lawsuits, do all kinds of things like that. But they don't have to report and read across their report, which we're getting to in the next part of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay, let's go to the next part of the bill.
Okay.
Or amendment, rather.
Subsection E allows the standing committee to report a measure from the committee during the interim. And what this means is the members vote on the passage of the bill to the next committee of referral. And the committee file is physically then transmitted by the staff of the committee to the clerk. So the bill is no longer in the possession of the committee. And that is the word, quote, report a measure. That's what the phrase means. A committee member who's voting telephonically or by teleconference shall sign a copy of the committee report and indicate on the copy the member's recommendation. The member shall send the signed copy by facsimile or other electronic means to the committee chair. The member shall also mail the original copy to the Senate secretary or the chief clerk of the House of Representatives as appropriate, so that there is an actual report. The facsimile immediately and the original would be there in the committee file. So they're not directing anybody to sign for us. They are actually signing themselves. And this is the difference between this version, the second difference between this version and Section 5 in House Bill 22, which didn't go anywhere. And then the chair of the committee shall deliver the committee report and the facsimile copy to the Senate secretary or chief clerk of the representatives to be taken up when the legislature convenes. Now, a bill can't move on to the next committee until after we convene, because it has to be read across the floor in open session. But this would allow the committee to do the committee work on bills that are in the possession of the committee, and would expedite the work of the legislature.
So in other words, if we have a bill and assigned to a committee, and it can be heard during the interim and action taken on that, and if it passes, that's it. It can go to one committee referral, but not two committees referral. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Any questions, Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering about the establishing of a quorum, and can we do that under this the way it is telephonically?
I understand we can. Ms. Cook,
through the chair.
Thank you. Through the chair. Could we inquire if Ms. Cook is still on the line?
Ms. Cook, are you still there?
Mr. Chairman, I am.
Did you hear the question?
Yes, it has to do with a quorum. I don't believe you need to address the quorum issue in this particular amendment, because no committee can act without a quorum. In addition, under our uniform rules, there is the signature requirement on a committee report is that a majority of the full membership must sign that report. That rule is not altered by this amendment. Right now, I would observe that committees of the legislature, including standing and special committees, do conduct business by teleconference during the session, and they establish quorums by teleconference with the presence of the individual who is attending electronically noted in the record. But right now, under our uniform rules, as they've been interpreted, during the interim, a person must be physically present to vote to report a bill from committee. But that's the only type of vote that I'm aware of that is not done via teleconference right now during sessions in committees. For example, an individual can attend a committee tomorrow of a standing committee and vote on everything, including the adoption of a CS or the adoption of amendment. electronically, but could not vote to pass the bill from the committee. That is the difference in this particular amendment.
So, in other words, we could vote for an amendment and so on, do an interim on a particular measure, but we could not pass it from committee?
Correct, sir.
Thank you.
During the session.
Well, yes. Representative Johnson, follow
thank
up.
You, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering what, and if it is even conceptually something we want to go to, what we would have to change, I understand it's a uniform rule change, to be able to pass a bill from one committee to the next during the interim.
This does it.
From but you can't and, pass it from one committee
this,
to the next.
This would do it.
Oh, I see.
Reverend.
Yes.
Grunberg?
Mr. Chair, as I understand the question is to allow the second committee to take the
to
bill
take
up.
Action, yeah. They can have it in their possession, but they can't act on it because it hasn't been read across.
Well, they can't even have it in their possession.
That's correct, yeah. That's
maybe Ms. Cook could answer that.
I believe that's correct. Ms. Cook? Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Right now, the way this amendment is written, it is contemplated that the committee report ultimately will go back to the full House and be read across when the House is convened in the manner that we have now. And this preserves the power of each individual House member or Senate member, as the case may be, to object to the committee report, because the only opportunity that, as a parliamentary matter, that an individual has to object to the accepting of a committee report for perhaps a procedural defect or whatever, is at the time that it is read across on the floor. Once that opportunity, once the bill goes into the second committee, the opportunity to object to a report is lost. So this approach preserves that. If it is the desire of the committee to set up a system whereby a bill travels from one committee to the next without being read across on the floor, the downside is the opportunity to object to the committee report is lost, and there may be some value gained. That's a public policy matter, and certainly this amendment could be changed to take that approach.
Thank you. Representative Johnson?
And this is probably something, if I would take some time, I could look in the Mason's manual, but can a bill be read across during a technical session?
Was that question directed to me?
I think it to anyone who might be able to answer
rules,
it.
Chair.
I could answer it, Mr. Chair, if you would
please,
like.
Please.
I believe that it is very dangerous to introduce a bill during a technical session, in my mind being one where a quorum has not been established on the record. And the reason I believe that introducing a bill during a technical session is a very poor practice is because the Constitution requires that each bill receive three readings. That's a constitutional dimension requirement. The act of introducing a bill constitutes the first reading. And so, as we know, the legislature cannot conduct business without a quorum being present, even though there is no vote required when the first reading is given, and therefore there is no motion made, and there is nothing that would, no record necessarily created of the lack of a quorum. If the issue came up, you would cast a potential doubt on the validity of the first reading of that bill.
Thank you, Representative Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I should ask Ms. Cook. Seemed to me like in the past we have read committee reports, though, in technical session. I've struggled with that, but I've actually seen it done. Have you had a ruling on that before?
If I may, through the chair, the direction in the Constitution and in Mason's manual is that the legislature conduct no business without a quorum, and accepting a committee report constitutes the conduct of business. And in that sense, it's probably not appropriate. Nonetheless, the reading of a committee report and referring the bill to the next committee is somewhat different in that it does not have a constitutional dimension. The reading of the report is not one of the three constitutionally required readings that a bill gets. You don't go to second reading until the bill is returned to the floor from the Rules Committee. So we don't have the constitutional cloud that as a result of the practice of reading a committee report. Now, obviously, if the legislature is in technical session, and by definition or practice, there is not a quorum present. That does not mean that a legislator could not attend and be available, and if that person objected to a particular committee report, that individual would have the right at that point to object to that report and presumably to place a call on the House. And at that point, technical session or no, the House would be obligated to get a quorum present and resolve the problem with the committee report. And for those reasons, it doesn't strike me as legally as serious a practice to read a committee report across as it does to attempt to introduce a bill.
Mr. Chairman, just to,
Reverend Cargill,
just to let you know, if I had anything to say about it, I wouldn't want committee reports to be read during the technical session, but I have seen it done, actually with a concurrence of both minority and majority members. That was an expedited matter, but I agree that any one individual in that body should be able to object to a committee report. So, generally speaking, I would object to it. And so, as long as I'm the rules chairman, that's going to be the direction I'd head, and I would encourage our speaker in that direction. So, I think that the process of the protecting every member of the body is so important.
Okay, and Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what I was getting at is that if the way this amendment is stated now, one committee could take action on a bill. And if it's a committee that has three committees of referral, that's it, just the one. But if there was a way to transmit and preserve the rights, even if it's by a call to the rules chair saying, I object to this bill being advanced, and then that bill is held. But if there's no objections by anyone, and we don't have, and very seldom have I seen anyone object to a committee report. It happens. No, it absolutely happens. But if we could somehow preserve the right, allow the bill to move to the next committee, I envision the first day of that 90-day session, an awful lot of committee work could have been done. And I think that's one of the things that we're going to have to address in getting our work done in 90 days is hitting the ground running. And I see this as a way in that second session to hit the ground running, because we'll have a full slate of bills when we get here for the floor.
Reverend Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the comments. I haven't taken that step here. If the committee wishes to take further steps, I have no objection. No.
I think it might be appropriate to hold off on that. So we are progressing through session here. We need to get this bill moving because of, you know, time is flying. Representative Roses?
I think the reason that I would object to doing that is because, you know, we're just sort of skirting on the edge with this of being able to almost then declare that we have a full-time legislature. And the other part to that is, you know, when you're working with a bill in committee, we often get wrapped around the axle on something and we fail to see something that we should have maybe seen. And then in the process that we have now, where it then gets read across the floor and assigned to another committee, it'll sometimes bring up issues and ideas that people hadn't thought about because they're busy off in their other committees doing things. And word gets around that, hey, did you see what happened in that committee? And the next thing you know, then we're in there trying to make modifications or amendments to something that we had not seen when we had it in committee. Because, you know, in committee you got seven people instead of, you know, the 40 in our body that are sitting out there trying to make sure that we're all doing the right thing. So I think this sort of starts pushing up against full-time legislators, and I don't think that's where the public wants us to go, or they wouldn't have given us a 90-day session. They would have changed it to 365 days, and they didn't do that.
Another thing, too.
But the other part, if I may finish, and then I'll probably not have any more to say on this bill. The other part that gives me a little bit concern about this also has to do with the amount of pressure that could be put on those seven committee members to try and get a bill pushed through in the interim that they probably would never have a chance to see in the light of day in a full session. So I think we've really circumvented the intent of the process when it was established that things be read three times and that it be referred and back across the floor simply to slow the process down so that you do have a chance to view things with a better view and in more detail. So with that, I think I would be opposed to going outside the parameters of what we've discussed.
Another thing, too, I was going to say that when we have a committee meeting such as this, we do have an opportunity to look at each other in the eye. You see certain body language reactions from the folks out there. It's a very different thing, even hearing testimony telephonically as compared to seeing somebody testifying here. It's something that we have to do, the nature of the business. But I think we tend to make better decisions when you look at each other and get the feeling, you know, where the committee is going. And somebody requested to speak next.
Who was it? Over here.
Representative Grunberg.
Yes, thank you. To respond to Representative Rose's, I did not intend to go up against the Constitution or the rules, so no action could be taken except giving the signed report to the clerk.
If I may.
One more question.
Clarify, appreciate it. No, I wasn't saying that at all. What I was speaking out was not speaking out in opposition to bills that have already been signed to committee being dealt with in the interim in this manner. I was objecting to a moving on to another committee.
Oh, okay.
That was my point. So I don't object to this.
Mr. Chairman.
One more than only one, two, three, okay?
Just very briefly, there is nothing in here, and I want it really clear on the record, that would prohibit a committee from meeting altogether and, you know, taking up the bill and signing it in person and then transmitting it to the clerk. That would be up to the chair. This would simply allow the committee to take up a bill.
That's when, of course, the expense of bringing people from all corners of Alaska, you know, we'd almost just soon come down here. I think you're next, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I would like to move on, and I apologize for bringing the concept forward.
That's why we have a committee.
I think that the discussion has been had, and I would like to move on to the main amendment.
Okay, first I want to, Reverend Cogger,
yes,
comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I actually warm up to the idea a little bit. In fact, my predecessor in the Rules Committee, Mr. Rokeberg, actually proposed a resolution. But I'm not ready for it yet, and I'll tell you why. The passing of bill to be read across, I could envision that the first day of session we'd have a lot of bills to read across that would not get the kind of scrutiny, I think, that that's needed. But I think the main objection I have at this point, and I'm not too sure how to address it, but I've been in teleconference meetings where I've met with Ledge Council. I've been in places where I've testified, and I'm sitting in this room with people who are, they have a legislator there, and they're telling them, giving them information. And the other committee members may not have either the benefit of seeing that information or even knowing that that influence is happening. I'm a little concerned about that yet. And I obviously, I don't know what to do about it. I would expect the integrity of the legislator to stand firm. But if I'm unaware of what I'm arguing against, I find that troublesome. So I like the idea of us all sitting around here. And if I see you getting notes from a particular source continually, then I might ask for an at ease and say, what's going on around here? But if I don't even know that it's going on. So those kind of things at this point, since we're so kind of super sensitive to ethics, I just struggle with it, and I'm just not ready to vote for this yet. Although I think the committee being able to move and take some action is important, I still think we should be gathered together. It's a costly and troublesome affair, and I for a fiscal conservative, I'd rather not spend that money getting people together. But if you're going to do state's business, I think it's that important.
Yeah.
Okay. Quickly, we have to take action.
I would like to respond to what Representative Coghill just said, and I think if you remember in this committee, one of the bills that we discussed had to do with making it illegal with a considerable amount of punishment that went along with that for somebody to change their vote based on somebody influencing them to do so. And by passing on committee and moving things along the way we do, as you just said, without being under the watchful eye of everybody being present, it would be very difficult for somebody to either prove or disprove whether or not that occurred when there was nobody else able to see what was going on because they were doing it over the telephone. As you said, there might be 7, 8, 10 other people in the room, and there's no way for you to know that unless they were actually spoke up and you heard their voice over the telephone. And so I think the concept is one that I don't have a lot of trouble with. It's the implementation of it that I'm having some concerns about, simply because I don't want us to put people in a situation where they have to potentially defend themselves against something that didn't happen but difficult to prove because there were no other sets of eyes in the room.
And that's another dimension of what I was saying earlier about our being able to sit here and look at each other and see what's going on. Representative Gernberg?
Thank you. I'd like to.
You just got passed a note. We're not answering the Okay.
The question was, do I want to withdraw the amendment? And the answer is no. I think it's a good amendment. It is going to be possible at any time for somebody physically to offer somebody a bribe or whatever. And if they're going to do it, they'll do it before the meeting. Generally, if we have meetings, I'd be at the Anchorage LIO, Mr. Coghill be Fairbanks LIO, Ketchikan LIO, wherever, in public. And that's the only place once I was sick and I was at home, that was the only time I can recall ever. That's not the normal thing. These meetings are conducted in public, and if we can't even hear the public and go out to the people, that's very serious. This allows us to have constituents actually come to meetings in the interim in their hometown. It's taking the legislature to the people, and I sure hope we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater here. This is one of the first real steps we've taken to ease us conducting our hearings in a state that's one-fifth the size of the United States. And I sure hope we don't lose sight of the ball for a potential like this. That would be very unfortunate.
Representative Dahl?
Yes, and I thank Representative Gruenberg for his remarks. I think they're important. You know, I just feel that this 90-day session is putting a lot of pressure on this, and I think the public is going to recognize it also as they review the what we're saying here in this meeting. I don't know how we may be able to conduct a 90-day session without doing something like this, and therefore I'd be willing to cast a yes vote for this, thinking that we can, as we go along, make it better and better and overcome any kind of objections to it. I certainly like the idea of having them in the individual cities and so forth, where people can come and listen in and actually attend the teleconference.
Okay, I think it's time to take some action on this. We're going to come in, then stand by just a moment.
Was Representative Dahl, were you just removing your
amendment? Yes, I am removing it, yes.
Oh, did you move the amendment?
No, I'm removing my objection.
You moved your objection, okay.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to, and this is an amendment to the amendment, but I think that if this is the only way that we can send in our vote is by mail, we might want to address that and include other means.
Representative Gruenberg?
No. The amendment provides that the member will sign a copy of the report,
right,
fax that in,
right,
and follow it up with mail.
And why wouldn't we restrict that to just mail when we could UPS it or something else?
Oh, that's fine with me.
And what I'm saying is other means, because
sure.
It's not that I don't trust the post office. It's that I don't
trust. Can't trust the post office. Whom can you trust?
So I'd just like to say by mail or other means, and just have that as a friendly amendment. That would allow for UPS, DHL.
Can you move that amendment?
I'd like to move
May
that.
May I draft amendment. That?
Why don't we just do that conceptual amendment?
Okay.
And without objection? Okay, fine. Amendment to amendment number 2, I think that is.
And I'll maintain my objection to the amendment, Mr. Chairman. I think.
Well, to the amendment to the amendment? Or the
no, to the main amendment.
As amended.
Okay, so with that, we have amendment number 3, which essentially sets forth guidelines for being able to hold committee meetings during the interim and procedures related to that to try to get it done. And I guess we need to take a vote at this point. Would you call the roll, please?
Amendment 3 as amended? Yes. Representative Coghill?
No.
Representative Johansson, not present. Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg?
Yes.
Representative Dahl?
Yes.
Representative Roses?
No.
Chair Lynn?
No.
Three yays, three nays.
Where's Johnson when you need him?
Okay. Three nays, three nays.
Can I vote twice?
Well, you can't vote twice. The amendment, it's a tie vote, so the amendment fails. With that, let's go to the CS for 171.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move CS for Hospital 171 State Affairs, version M, as amended, out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Okay. Any objection? If not, CS for Hospital 171 has passed without objection, and these things look so simple, but they're really not simple, and that's why we had the committee process to flush out some of these things. Okay, with that, thank you very much, Reverend Cargill, for that, and I guess this goes to the Judiciary Committee next, does it?
Goes to the floor, Mr. Chairman.
Goes to the floor.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so let's go now to next bill, which would be HB 179, and we have, I see, 179 PERS TERS system, and we're going to take short IDs while we sign the paperwork. Yes. I'd like to call the House State Affairs Committee back to work, or out of Eddie's to work. We now be hearing, as I said, CS for House Bill number 171, which relates to PERS and TERS. 179. Well, we do 171 again. We didn't like it the first time, we do it again. 179.
That's right.
Okay. Welcome, Representative Kelly.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Representative Mike Kelly, and with me this morning, I've got my staffer, Derek Miller. What I'd like to do is break open the bill for you here in just a short presentation. I know that that we've got time crunch today with the session coming at 10 o'clock, but we do hope to make a good start on this. House Bill 179 is an omnibus-type bill in that it handles several things, and we'll just go over them briefly at the beginning here. The state of Alaska's retirement system has an unfunded liability approaching $10 billion. And the PERS system is currently only about 65% funded, and the TERS system is about 60% funded. When I came down here a little over 2 years ago, the numbers were roughly half what they are now. A lot of folks thought it would go away. A lot of folks thought there was some homeostatic self-healing device in there. Hasn't proven to be the case. So we went to work on Senate Bill 141. We got that defined contribution in place, but that still left us with the problem of the unfunded liability. And there seems to be quite a will in the legislature and both bodies and with the administration to find a fix for that. House Bill 175 would implement a comprehensive plan to return the retirement system to soundness. It establishes a cost-sharing plan to eliminate the unfunded liability in both the PERS and the TERS plans. It obligates the state for 80% of the unfunded liability, and other employers would come to the table with a 20% contribution to the pay down of the unfunded liability. Also included in the bill is a plan to raise contribution rates for about 48,000 active legislators, the governor, commissioners, judges, police officers, firefighters, teachers, equipment operators, clerks, accountants, et cetera, all of the folks that are active in the plan. And this contribution level would be 5% above the current contribution rates. That would be, depending on the tax bracket, 3 to 4% contribution after taxes. The employee contributions would go toward the cost of providing employee benefits in the current period. We're all aware that in order to bring the beneficiaries to the table, it has to be done in a fashion that we do not have a problem with constitutionality and have the court overturn what we do. This three-way partnership of the state, at 80%, the employers at 20%, both related to the unfunded liability. And the current beneficiaries, including folks in the legislature, stepping up to the plate for an additional 5% pre-tax on the current period costs, would ensure that everyone has skin in the game, and I think would demonstrate to non-beneficiary Alaskans that there's a partnership in this sacrifice involved in extinguishing the unfunded liability. This liability may be with us in the area of somewhere near $750 million for the next 25 years. So it's not as if what we do here by setting a formula for a fix that we somehow do away with it. This bill also makes technical changes required to the state's defined contribution plan, and those changes are related to IRS compliance and some other technical fixes that are required. The Alaska Retirement Management Board, the ARM Board, recently adopted employer average contribution rates of 54% of wages for TERS and 39% of wages for PERS for FY08. Now, there are, to any business person, that level of contribution just for that part of the package would threaten the continued existence of any business, would sink most of them smack below the waterline. And so we have a tremendous challenge for our employers who are faced with these rates, and bankruptcies and elimination of service, the critical services in our communities, should be averted if we put House Bill 179 in place. These rates, if the state picks up 80%, will be at a very high level, unarguably. And there's a lot of there's a lot of grousing about the high level. As you know, some of the municipals have come in with an 85-15 fix that they've proposed. So this is not exactly what they'd like. It's higher than that, but it certainly, unarguably, goes a long way toward meeting their needs. This bill would also accommodate any slam downs in payments, any payments through a debt mechanism or a cash infusion. So pension obligation bonds are accommodated in this bill. Any cash infusions, such as the governor has proposed on her side and various others have proposed, would be accommodated. This bill also changes the PERS system, which has an individual rate for each of the 100-plus employers. This would change it to a single cost-sharing rate. That's a very important consideration because we've got rates from as high as 185% of hourly wage to as low as close to zero for the coming year. I think in wrap-up, it's important to understand what this bill does and what it doesn't do. It doesn't look back at how we got in the mess. We spent, a couple of years looking at that. We changed out the actuaries. We've got a new ARM board. We've got a defined contribution plan for the next person in the door. So it doesn't look back at how we got here, and it doesn't create a single dollar to pay down the unfunded liability, somehow pick that out of the ozone layer or create it in a comfortable, easy, non-sacrificing way. It takes it right out of the classroom, right out of the road maintenance, right out of everything else we're doing. But what it does do is puts this problem in the rearview mirror for us as to the mechanism. Instead of every year having to go through this wrestle, this would provide a cost-sharing mechanism and complete the tough task of setting a method for restoring solvency and good health to our defined benefit plans. Now, you may argue that this is too big a lift for the state at 80%. Yeah, it is. It's huge. It's horrible. It's unbelievable. But 80% is probably about what it's going to take to do it. You may argue that it will upset active plan members, maybe including yourselves. I think 5% is a bargain. After tax, 3-4%, being asked to come to the table for that is absolutely an extremely reasonable contribution. I realize the difficulty of applying that, but that does not change my sense that it absolutely must be done. I would argue that when the all-in cost of providing these benefits under the defined benefit plans has tripled since 1999, it's actually triple in both systems, that the legislature would be derelict in our duties to the non-beneficiary Alaskans if we did not require all the parties to step up to the table, including active beneficiaries who enjoy the benefits of the old systems, which have proven, as Buck Consultants, a new actuary, stated, to be very rich benefits, and they're unsustainable. No employer can sustain 54% and 39% rates. So we've got to step up to the plate. I'm here to tell you that I think this mechanism will work. The added ingredient that this has over what you might see out there is this brings an active army of 40,000, 48,000 roughly, beneficiaries to the table to help with the payment at a very reasonable rate. Now, I've got a, regarding the challenge of exactly how to accomplish this without triggering a Supreme Court flip is certainly not lost on me. It's not lost on any one of you. You know that what the challenge is. You remember those of you who were here last year, or those of you who are new this year but probably followed it last year, that there were legislative legal opinions, there were AG opinions, and they're out there. What I did is recently met with our new Attorney General, Talis Kohlberg, the thought being that he's our new kid on the block in the legal shop, and that we probably ought to have a dialogue with him about what he thinks relative to something like this. And the big change since the last AG looked at it is just the huge, crushing size of this thing. And so we've asked, I have set before you a letter that I wrote to the Attorney General. Okay, you've got it. And I met with him recently. Good conversation. Including myself, believe that this is an easy matter, but we've asked for him to engage on it. What House Bill 179 does is it puts in there one method that might work. If it doesn't work, then I think there are more tougher measures, wage freezes, wage reductions, no more contract increases, potential layoffs, whatever you want to name, because we're going into a 10-year deficit. There isn't a single one of you that would challenge me on that. Not a single one of you. It's a bipartisan understanding that we're going back in the brush as far as finances go, and we'll stay there until the gas line comes. And so I ask you to give this bill serious consideration. As you know, the governor has dropped a bill on both sides, a technical fix. This bill includes those components on the technical fix as well. And as you know, some of you who have been tracking this, the technical fixes have been morphing and morphing and morphing as we go along, and that's understandable. This bill was I guess, about the earliest introduction of an omnibus-type approach. We started working on this early. But we understand from Legal that keeping up with all of the places where this is being worked on, that the technical fix is maturing as we go along. So the legal component we're looking at, this bill has what is maybe a likely way that it could work. And if you read the material, you'll see what the thinking is on how the plans have improved, and how perhaps restoring plans that are underwater to financial health just may be a plan enhancement, a betterment, better than what it is now. That in fact, if you look back to the time when the rates were set. Mr. Chairman, you needed a new shoulder then, or a new knee, or whatever. They just weren't doing that then. And if you needed a soft tissue MRI, you were stuck because they didn't have it yet. And if you
need a new everything,
but you can get it just about now. But what we haven't done is recognize that during all those changes with ultrasound, MRI, CT scan, spare joints for just about anywhere you want them. All the things, laser surgery, all the things, longer life, that's one of the things that's driving this plan underwater, as we're living longer.
Yep, sorry.
No apologies there from us older folks. But my point is, we have not changed the rate we look at one side with the court and say, oh, no, no, you just can't raise these contribution rates, while the plan triples in the all-in cost, without saying how we got here, but the all-in cost has tripled, and we haven't touched the rates. And I think that we are derelict if we do not step up to the plate here, and I hope we do not hide behind the worry that we can't do this because of the Supreme Court, because there are other ways than the rate. I hope we don't have to go there. I hope there's a way to do it through the rate, because this proposal at 3 to 4% after bless you, after taxes is a tremendously, it's a bargain. It's a bargain. So, Mr. Chairman, think at this point in time, in finance, I kind of expect all these bills are coming together. We've got the governor's bills on each side.
And that would be 204 and 206?
Mm-hmm. And then we've got Senate Finance, which I just talked to Commissioner Kreitzer. She's over there testifying there, or she would be here today tracking this. But that bill of both the technical fix and the 6535 is moving ahead over there. Same thing on the House side. We had a hearing in Ways and Means, I think, yesterday.
204 and 206.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And so this is an omnibus approach, but it has an added component. There are things that we can cover as we go along relative to more detail on the bill. But thank you, Mr. Chairman, for scheduling this bill and for giving us this opportunity to break it open here this morning.
Thank you very much. When you say omnibus, that's kind of scary, having gone through the ethics legislation. Mm. But I wanted to ask, two questions. If we had done this, not counting some of the other fixes, but if we'd done 179 before we passed SB 141, would that have been good then also?
They are like this. They're virtually unrelated, because one of them said the next person in the door is not going to create unfunded liability now or hopefully ever, because it's a defined contribution. That set that so that as we moved ahead, the next people in the door wouldn't be part of the growing problem. What this does is says, okay, but we have unarguably, and not created by the employees or the legislators or the judges or anybody else in the plan, because it's the only plan that they had available to them. So I'm not hammering them, although sometimes I'm credited with that, let's say. But the fact of the matter is they're different, Mr. Chairman, so that one is now trying to set a mechanism to extinguish the unfunded liability. 141 merely said that as we go forward, we won't get more from the next person.
Well, what I meant was this is to extinguish the unfunded liability, which we had before we passed SB 141. So would it not have been good to have something like this to help extinguish unfunded liability, whether 141 passed or not?
You could have done that.
That's my point. So we could well have considered this before we had the contentious battle on SB 141.
I don't think anybody, Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, I don't think anybody was ready to do that at that point in time. There were still folks in La La Land thinking this thing was just going to go away, put a Band-Aid, and away we go. Not going to happen.
Yeah, I left La La Land and moved up here from the Los Angeles area. the employee contribution, could you put it in terms, at least I can understand, if somebody has a $25,000 a year salary, or $50,000 a year salary, or $100,000 a year salary, how much more would be coming out of our pocketbooks at those three different salary ranges?
We can do that for you pre and post tax, but it's 5% pre tax, and for the average employee, in fact, we'll get to that. I'd be guessing.
Yeah, I'd like to know that. So we, you know, we have these numbers, but the people concerned about it, they, you know, how much money is that out of my pocket? And you know, how much is it going to cost me in my $24,000 a year? No, I think $24,012 a year, for crying out loud, salary. And how much is it going to cost people at higher salary ranges? What's it going to cost a teacher, average teacher, out of their salary? And the executive at the $100,000 a year.
Mr. Chairman, we have a bargain for all of you. It's 5%,
3%, special deal for UGI.
But we will give you that information just as you have asked.
I'd like to add it. I think, Representative Rosen, you had a question?
Right, and an easy overview of that is if you did it as a as 5% of the gross, it's $5,000 on $100,000, it's $2,500 on $50,000, and it's $1,250 on $25,000 if it were 5% of the gross, but it's not.
He's a math teacher, why we let him on this committee.
It's the only reason we let him on the committee. I have several questions. The first would be if you take a look at your walkthrough that you presented us with on House Bill 179 and go to page 2.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, Representative Rose, just one thing. We can, and it is certainly your choice, we can go through the walkthrough, which may cut down on the questions, or we can start now with questions. It's certainly your pleasure, but we're ready to go either way.
Let's take his question first, okay, sure. Then we'll do the rest of the walkthrough.
Thank you.
Okay, I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And the reason I referenced this, even though you haven't necessarily gone through the walkthrough, is because you did mention some of these items in your introduction. And I'll just use the TERS rate, for example, because that's the one that I'm the most familiar with. And you stated on here the 54.03%. Is that the proposed ARM board rate for FY08 to meet the actuarial responsibilities?
Through the chair, yes, Representative.
Okay, so that one hasn't been implemented yet. That's the one that's recommended.
That's correct.
Okay. Do you know what the current TERS contribution rate is for FY07 that was passed last year? Do you know what that rate is currently today?
We have that, Mr. Chairman. That is in the 20, and it's in the early 20s.
24.86 or something like that?
Yes.
Okay. So the establishing an 80-20 split, so if for some reason the actuaries came back next year, as had happened in the past, and say, you know, we had made some decisions early on that we didn't think would affect the unfunded liability, but now we realize we were wrong, and so therefore it's not $12 million anymore, it's $28 million. So they would still have to pick up 20% of that difference. So it has an automatic escalator for every year. If the fund goes up or if the fund goes down, it goes with it because it's a percentage.
Mr. Chairman, that's right. This leaves the what Representative Roses is referring to, Mr. Chairman, is the volatility of the system. And the volatility stays in here. Conscious decision to say that if we haven't got it pinned down right now, the state isn't stepping in here and saying, no matter what you do to your plans or what happens in the market or what happens out there, we're going to give you a shot of Novocaine, Fairbanks, Kenai, North Pole, and you're not going to see that volatility. We're in there for a portion of it, but your portion stays volatile. And so that Representative Roses, the answer to that is yes. The exposure to just what you said remains, and you could have another day of reckoning.
Okay, and if I may continue, the 5% employee contribution rate, as you described it here, so that everybody has skin in the game, that would be a 5% that would be deducted from the wages of everybody that is currently employed under either any of those tiers that currently falls under this TRS or PERS system, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that would be for those in the defined benefit plans. That
right.
The answer
that are currently employed.
Correct.
Do you happen to know the numbers of people that are currently collecting a retirement benefit that are not employed versus the number that are employed?
We can make that available to you. I don't have that top of mind.
Okay, because the reason that I asked that question is I know there's two for sure that are collecting benefits. That's me and my wife. Right. So you know, I want to make that perfectly clear that I can tell you there's at least two.
Disclosure.
So what this sounds like to me is that so that we can create skin in the game, we're going to ask those that are currently working to pay for the benefits that are being received by those that are no longer working. So not only are they putting skin in the game, but it sounds like they may be putting a little hide with it.
Mr. Chairman, that might not be too different from how I would describe it.
All right. Representative Dahl?
Right. Yes, thank you. That 5%, is that just frozen, or is that going to increase with medical costs as they continue to go up?
Mr. Chairman, with this bill, that would be set. In other words, that 5%, if you were 7% now, that would go to 12. And although the volatility in the system could move it up and down for the employer, for the beneficiary, that would be set.
Representative Rosas?
Thank you. I could go on for a long time, but one of the things that...
You can go on until 10 o'clock.
Yeah. One of the things that I've had some concern over, and this is we continue to look at adjustments just at the contribution rate. But then we turn around and say that much of the unfunded liability is created because of the the unpredictability of the medical costs. But yet I don't see where we've done anything to try and address how we've recovered some of those costs. Now, I do know that in the past, the state tried to adjust retirees' benefits, and there was a lawsuit, and there was a decision made that you can't do that. But as I recall, that decision said you can't diminish the quality of the benefits that you have provided. But I don't know anywhere where it says you can't do cost containment measures, where you can't set up a system of preferred providers or set up a system of contractual obligations where you could reduce the cost of an MRI from $850 to $250 because you had a negotiated rate. I haven't seen us talk about or try to go to some of those, and I think that would have much more of a profound impact on it than just looking only at a rate structure. The very thing that you spoke about and all of the tests that we have and all of the replacements that we have for people's joints and so on, there are states that are looking at medical containment costs, and one of the things that they have done is established strict protocols as to when a procedure would be necessary or when a further test would be recommended. And it's shown considerable medical cost savings for those states. And so while I understand what you're trying to do here, and I appreciate the fact that you're trying to create a level playing field, I think until we address those other costs, that all we've done is address the money and we haven't addressed the cause. I mean, it's sort of like going to the doctor and he treats the symptoms but not the cause. And so I think we have a lot of work to do in a lot of areas besides just adjusting the rates. And I know you didn't want to get into the discussion of how did we get here, because the fact of the matter is we're here. But unless I'm mistaken, early on in when the Persian TERS was established, there was three contribution levels. There was the state's contribution, there was the employee's contribution, there was the employer's contribution. At some point in time, when the actuary stated that we were over 100% funded, I believe the rate was 107% funded, and oil was at $8 a barrel, the administration at that particular time said, then why are we continuing to pay into Persian TERS when it's overfunded? And they quit. And at some point in time, up until money was added to the foundation formula, the state made no more contributions. So I think a considerable amount of what created the unfunded liability, besides the increase in medical costs, was the state's unwillingness to continue to contribute to a fund that was established. And so therefore, if we're going to try to put skin in the game, I think we need to take a look at where we started creating some of the problems. And I appreciate the fact that you're saying the state will pick up 80%. I guess my concern is that enough? And my concern is, with a 5% escalator clause in there, if we're going to be at 24.89% for next year, and there's the potential for that percentage to continue to shift, at some point in time, if the municipalities and small school districts become insolvent, the state's going to eat 100% of it, not just 80%. So I think we need to look for something that's going to hold everybody harmless, but let's move us to where we need to be. And if I knew what the magic numbers were, I'd have helped you write the bill. But I don't.
Yeah. Representative Kelly.
Good comments, Mr. Chairman. And on those cost containment measures, I will co-sponsor with you on probably each of those. And there's another problem that we have that isn't covered directly by that. The other day in House Finance, we did an amendment to cover parking for certain employees in Anchorage. In other words, to cover parking. That's a defined benefit. If the cost of parking in Anchorage close enough to the building to survive the court's test of whether the benefit hadn't changed. Let's just say it's heated, covered with a head bolt heater, and the cost of land under that, all the parking areas within 300 yards of that building go from, let's just pick a number, $1,000 a year to furnish that, to $12,000 a year, because the cost of the square foot went from $3 to $20, or whatever the numbers are. Have we stepped up for another defined benefit when we provide that parking? Just a question. I don't have an answer. But I suspect, in addition to what Representative Rose has mentioned, Mr. Chairman, our benefit system has a lot of other areas that are defined benefits that should be converted to defined contributions. Example, I'll give you $5 to park your car. I won't give you a guaranteed forever benefit that I'll park it for you. But I'll give you $5. Go find a place to park. Not against helping with the parking. Understand that. But the additional point in the cost containment that Representative Rose has mentioned is we have other defined benefits that need converting as well. And I would join folks on those bills as co-sponsors, likely as also.
There's a whole new dimension.
And one last thing. Part, and it's referenced in the letter to the AG in a manner which I tried to make not offensive, but get the point across. The benefits cartel, it's a round table. Legislators are in it, so if you want something, they get it too. You don't think it ought to be taken away, go check with the judge. She's in it too. You want to change something like that, how about getting some help from the administration? This is not critical of any human being on the face of the planet. Go to the administration to change it. You put the sword in their belly as well. So try to go get something added. I'd give you odds that you might find that relatively easy. Go try to take something away or make a hard decision. You might just find that benefits cartel is nearly impossible to work with as far as tough decisions go. And you're looking at somebody that's had his feet in this thing, ankles, knees, right up to my neck since I got down here, and we've got some problems. This bill takes one step or two in the direction. It sets a formula, and at least to the miserable level of 3 to 4% after taxes, brings the beneficiaries along, and I think you can face non-beneficiary Alaskans and say, a small move, but look, they've stepped up to the plate, they're helping. Let's make this 80% lift. I didn't mean to go too far, but you're on, Mr. Chairman, the Representative Rose's points are well taken.
If I may,
Representative Rose,
let me give you an example of you're absolutely right when you're trying to take away a benefit. I tried for 3 weeks prior to come to the legislature to give a benefit away, and I couldn't do it.
No,
I'll give you an example. I'm a retired teacher, so therefore I have medical coverage under the TRS system, the very system we're talking about here. My wife's a retired teacher, so she's covered. Well, the fact that she's covered, I'm also covered under her policy, so I have two. Now that I got elected to the legislature, I have a third. So when it was time to sign up for the benefit package as a legislature, I contacted the department and said, I don't want the coverage, I don't need it, I'm already double covered. You know, I pay very little out of my own pocket for health insurance, and I'm very appreciative of that. I felt like I earned it. So could you please waive me out of it? I'm sorry, sir, there is no way to do that. I said, well, I'm not sending in the paperwork. She said, well, then that means you'll go to the default position if you don't select one. I said, could you tell me what that relates to? She says, well, that means that we'd be paying $879 a month for your medical policy, even though you don't want it. I said, do you realize you're paying $879 to cover me at a rate of 4%? Because that's the only part I'm paying out of my pocket, because I'm already double covered. We have no mechanism by which to do that. Now, I haven't gone through this entire building to find out how many of that occurs, but I know of four people in two offices that are in the same position that I'm in. We do need to fix some of these things, and I think we can fix them. Now, is canceling out my $879 a month going to save the state and the unfunded liability? No, it isn't. But it's an absurdity that needs to be fixed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kelly?
Oh, I, I don't disagree with anything that the representative said, quite supportive.
That he said so far?
So far.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering about how this relates to collective bargaining and are we contractually obligated for certain periods that we can't raise this contribution level? Where does that play into it? Can we do that under the collective bargaining agreements that we have today?
Mr. Chairman, yes. The legislature controls benefits. You and I could probably argue till dawn on whether that was the right course to take or the wrong course to take, but that's where we are.
Do that. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. You want to continue on?
Yes,
the walkthrough?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I introduced Derek Miller. If I might turn it over to him, and we can at least make a few yards ahead on the...
I would like to adjourn about quarter of or 10 minutes of, because we have to go to floor session.
Your pleasure, Mr. Chairman, and we'll start.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Derek Miller, and I'm staff to Representative Mike Kelly. And before you today, obviously, is House Bill 179. It's a highly technical bill. There's some technical aspects to it, and I'll just run through it section by section, if that's okay with the committee, in a real brief manner as best I can. Section 1 of the bill, which we've already been talking about this morning, requires employees in the defined benefit teachers' retirement plan to contribute an additional 5% above current employee contribution rates. Section 2 changes the calculation of the employer contribution rate to be spread across the entire payroll base instead of just the DB payroll base. Section 3 adds definitions for the employer normal cost rate and past service cost rate, and again clarifies that the rate applies to the entire payroll base. Section 4, effective July 1st, 2010, removes the provision that allows members to repay refunded contributions for the purpose of obtaining a conditional service benefit. And what this means is, if you were a Tier 2 employee and you retire tomorrow and you cash out all of your contributions, if you rehire after July 1st, 2010, you are in the defined contribution plan. Section 5 adds a provision for TERS DB plan members who employ with new employers that join the system after July 1st, 06, and do not participate in the DB plan, that they will be in the TERS defined contribution plan. Section 6 clarifies that the TERS defined contribution plan is a qualifying hybrid plan. The defined contribution plan is a hybrid plan, meaning that there are defined benefit components, for example, medical, death and disability components, survivors pension are all defined benefit components of the defined contribution plan, so this qualifies both those aspects of it. Section 7 requires employers in the TERS to pay occupational disability and death benefits through contributions calculated actuarially. Contributions will be deposited to a separate trust account for this purpose. Section 8 clarifies that the defined contributions paid into the member's individual account are subject to limitations of federal code, and fixed benefits paid under the plan are subject to similar federal codes. Section 9 clarifies that a member may direct investment of an individual account among available investment funds as set out by the ARM Board, the Alaska Retirement Management Board, and I believe that there are 10 current separate investment options for an employee to make. Section 10 clarifies the termination of a disability benefit when a person no longer meets the requirements to receive occupational disability benefits or recovers from a disability. Section 11 stipulates that once the member is appointed to disability, the member is 100% vested in all the employer contributions made to the member's individual account, regardless of years of service. Section 12 clarifies the termination of disability benefits when a disabled member first qualifies for normal retirement. Section 13, changes made to this subsection mirror other changes being made to the disability and death statute throughout the bill, and I won't go into great detail. It's just going to be a 30,000-foot look at this bill here. Section 14 clarifies the definition of occupational disability, and this section is on page 7 if you want the full definition of that. Section 15 adds an annual adjustment to occupational disability benefits equal to 75% of the Anchorage Consumer Price Index, or 9%, whichever is less. Section 16 clarifies the termination of a survivor's pension under the occupational death benefit provisions, including the end of death benefits when a dependent child no longer meets the definition of dependent. Section 17 clarifies that a survivor of a member who died from occupational causes is not entitled to elect distribution from the member's individual account while also receiving those same survivor benefits. Section 18, the amendment in this subsection, 1, clarifies the normal retirement benefits available to survivors of members who died occupationally, 2, establishes a tax-qualified mechanism for the plan, and 3, clarifies that the period of death benefits constitutes membership service. Section 19 actually has two parts. The first part being it adds an annual adjustment to the survivor's pension benefit equal to 50% of the Anchorage CPI, or 6%, whichever is less. And the second part of that section adds a provision that a person whose disability or survivor benefits are terminated due to eligibility for normal retirement benefits will be treated as if that person is eligible for Medicare, regardless of age, for the purpose of cost-sharing medical premiums with the plan. Section 20 clarifies that the non-guarantee clause contained in this section relates only to the defined contribution portion of the TERS defined contribution plan. The fixed benefits under this plan are defined by statute, so those are not going to be encumbered under the non-guarantee clause. Section 21 clarifies that Internal Revenue Code Section 415C limits apply to employer matching contributions when a DB member elects to convert to a DCR member. And what these limits are might be better explained by some Department of Administration folks if you have further questions on specific limitations. Section 22 clarifies that transferring membership service from a TERS DB plan to the TERS defined contribution plan will be applied to vesting in both employer's matching contribution and subsequent employer contributions. Section 23 provides a time limit, time limit being 12 months from the date an employer consents to the conversion from a DB to a DC plan, within which an eligible employee can make a decision to transfer from a DB to a DC plan. Section 24 removes the Social Security taxable wage base cap from the definition of eligible compensation for contribution purposes. Section 25, which is a cost-sharing component, this isn't a technical fix, this is a cost-sharing component of the bill, and it actually has three sections. Two of those sections establish the teacher retirement system past service cost liability account and the public employee retirement system past service cost liability account, and clarifies that the Commissioner of Revenue is responsible to distribute a payment based on 80% of the payroll base for each employer. This is getting into the 80-20 cost sharing that we had mentioned before. And the third and final part of that, Section 25, clarifies the definition of past service cost rate. Section 26 authorizes the Commissioner of Administration to promulgate regulations to implement the state's group life and health insurance statutes, including the new Alaska Retiree Health Trust statute. Section 27 clarifies the duties of the administrator for the Alaska Supplemental Benefits System, also known as SBS. Section 28 returns the authority for adopting regulations for the SBS from the Alaska Retirement Board, the ARM Board, to the Commissioner of Administration. Section 29 changes the reference from board to commissioners, just a simple technical clarification there. Section 30 adds a provision under SBS for a member, annuitant, or beneficiary to appeal a decision of the administrator to the Office of Administrative Hearings. Section 31 adds a provision under the Health Reimbursement Arrangement Plan for a member to appeal a decision of the administrator to the Office of Administrative Hearings as well. Section 32 clarifies the administrator to establish a Teachers and Public Employees Retiree Health Reimbursement Arrangement Plan Trust Fund. Section 33 changes the employer contribution from an individual employer contribution amount to a uniform employer contribution amount for all participants of the HRA plan. Section 34, which is similar to Section 1 of the bill for TERS, requires employees in the defined benefit public employees retirement plan to contribute an additional 5% above current employee contribution rates, which again we've spoken of previously. Section 35 and 36 kind of team up. This is where we, as was also mentioned before, try to get the PERS employer rates to be one consolidated cost sharing rate as the TERS employer rate is currently set. Right now there's 160 different employers in the PERS system and they all each pay a different rate, and this both sections 35 and 36 change that to cost sharing rate, so all 160 employers are paying the same rate. Section 37 Effective July 1st, 2010, removes the provision that allows employees to repay refunded contributions for purpose of obtaining a public service benefit. And again, this is similar to Section 4 of the bill. You'd have to, we might have some folks available who can better, who are better suited to explain the differences in 37 and 38. They're really similar, so I can't go into great detail on that. Section 39 adds a provision for appeal to the Office of Administrative Hearings of the Commissioner's decisions on waiver requests under PERS. Section 40 incorporates the reference to the new administrator section into the definition of administrator under the PERS DB plan, and the administrator basically has two responsibilities, and one, to administer the plan, and two, to adopt regulations, is what you'll find. Section 41 adds a provision for PERS DB plan members who employ with new employers that join the PERS after July 1st, 06, but they are not eligible to participate in the DB plan, and not eligible to participate in the PERS DB plan to participate in the PERS DC plan. Section 42 clarifies that the PERS defined contribution plan is a qualified hybrid plan. Section 43 clarifies that the employer contributions for the defined benefits under this subsection will be deposited to a separate trust account to the plan. Section 44 clarifies that the defined contributions paid into the member's individual account are subject to limitations of federal code, and the fixed benefits paid to the DC plan are subject to similar federal code. You'll find that some of these technical fixes are replicated across both PERS and TERS. Section 45 clarifies the termination of a disability benefit when a person no longer meets the requirements to receive occupational disability benefits. Section 46 stipulates that once a member is appointed to disability, the member is 100% vested in all the employer contributions made to the member's individual account, regardless of years of service worked. 47 clarifies the termination of disability benefits when a disabled member first qualifies for normal retirement. Section 48 stipulates that a monthly pension benefit for normal retirement by a disabled police officer or firefighter will be paid first by the member's account, then from the trust account for which it is established the purpose for. Section 49, changes made to this subsection mirror other changes being made to the disability and death statutes throughout this bill, and again, I won't go into great detail on those five changes contained in this section. It's similar to Section 13 of the bill as well, you'll find. Section 50 clarifies the definition of occupational disability and establishes the eligibility requirements. Section 51 adds an annual adjustment to occupational disability benefits and to retirement benefits elected by disabled peace officers and firefighters, and it's equal to 75% of the increase in the anchored CPI, or 9%, whichever is less. Section 52 clarifies the termination of a survivor's pension under the occupational death benefit provisions, including the end date of survivor benefits when a dependent child no longer meets the definition of dependent. Section 53 clarifies that a survivor of a member who died from occupational causes is not entitled to elect distributions from the member's individual account while also receiving survivor benefits. Section 54, and this Section 54 is similar to Section 18, so I won't go over that section again. Section 55 has two parts. It adds an annual cost of living adjustment to the survivor's pension benefit equal to 50% of the anchored CPI, or 6%, whichever is less. And then the second part of that section adds a provision that a person whose disability or survivor benefits are terminated due to eligibility for a normal retirement will be treated as if the person is eligible for Medicare, again, for the purpose of cost-sharing medical premiums with the plan. Section 56 clarifies that the non-guarantee clause relates only to the defined contribution portion of the plan and not the defined benefit plan, for PERS. Section 57 clarifies that Internal Revenue Code Section 415C limits apply to employer matching contributions when a DB member elects to convert to the DC plan. Section 58 clarifies that transferred membership from a PERS DB plan to a PERS DC plan will be applied to vesting in both employers' matching contributions and subsequent employer contributions. And again, Section 59 provides another time limit for the PERS system of 12 months for which the member can choose to switch from a DB plan to a defined contribution plan. Section 60 has two parts. First part being, it adds a provision for employers to designate classes or groups of employees eligible to participate in or to be excluded from the PERS DC plan. The second part adds the process by which an employer may terminate participation from the DC plan and outlines the rights of the employees and the cost to the employer upon the termination. 61, again, applying it to the PERS system removes the Social Security taxable wage base cap from the definition of eligible compensation for contribution purposes. Section 62 clarifies that a member and an employee have the same meaning throughout the PERS DC statutes. There's, in speaking with our drafter, he had some concerns on what we're calling these folks, and this was to make it uniform. Section 63 provides a clear definition of peace officer and firefighter under the DC plan. Last page. Section 64 adds language for the powers and duties of the Deferred Compensation Program Administrator. Section 65 clarifies that the administrator of the Deferred Compensation Program may contract with actually a private person to administer that plan. Section 66 adds a provision under the Deferred Compensation Plan for a member to appeal a decision to the Office of Administrative Hearings. Section 67 adds the Supplemental Benefit Annuity Plan, the Health Reimbursement Arrangement Plan, the Deferred Compensation Plan, and waivers of adjustment under the PERS and TERS DB plans to the jurisdiction of the Office of Administrative Hearings. Section 68 removes the National Education Association as a participating employer in the TERS. Section 69, and I had a question actually on page 69, on section 69 here, which repeals reinstatement of service in the TERS plan for which a member receives a refund of contributions. I can come back to that. Section 70 and section 71 provide effective dates. That's the
thank you very much, Bill. We're going to be meeting on this again Saturday. Where, as a sponsor, Bill, would you like to begin the discussion at our next meeting?
Well, Mr. Chairman, since we've kind of gone over the general bill and laid out all the sections in the walkthrough here, I think your pleasure, just what you'd like to do.
All right. With that, I'll have a piece of paper here. We will be meeting again Saturday, House State Affairs Committee, at 10 o'clock, continuing the discussion on this important legislation. And it'll be 10 o'clock on Saturday, again on the PERS, TERS bill. We have Bill Bjork with the NEA Alaska is here with us. I'm sorry, sir, we don't have time to get to that today. I suspect you'll be around here. You're talking this bill. Any other business to come before the committee at this time? Representative Roses?
I won't get into any lengthy discussion here, but there are a couple of items that would be helpful in the discussion if we could get them. under the TERS umbrella, could you find for me what percentage of the school districts are not under a unified borough or a municipality where they contribute to the system and it's just straight funds coming from the state? What percentage we have? And the other one was the percentage of retirees that are receiving benefits as compared to the percentage of people that are currently employed in the Tier 1, 2, 3, so that we see where we are on those numbers. And another one that would be helpful out of the 160 employees, different employers that are under the PERS umbrella, how many of those are state government? Have you broken them out by departments, or is the state just considered one of the 160? Because it doesn't matter what you do with the 5% there, the state picks up the whole tab anyway. So if we could have those numbers, I think it would help in perpetuating the discussion.
Thank you very much. And with that, the House Trade Affairs Committee is adjourned at 8 minutes of 10. Thank